Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
This was a violent attack. It was senseless and I'm so sorry it happened.
An ISIS supporter on the rampage in New Zealand, former Al-Qaeda double agent Ayman Dean, takes us inside the next chapter of global Islamist extremism. Then, 20 years after 9/11.
Now you people understand we're not going to be able to haggle every case subjectively. That's where the math comes in.
The new film starring Michael Keaton as lawyer Ken Feinberg, who decided the worth of each life lost in the attacks. Also,
it was bigger than football. It's bigger than just winning. Like, we got to really save lives.
Walter Isaacson looks at a high school football program changing lives and saving lives in New Orleans. And
I hope this sends a message around the world that immigrants and refugees are, they add so much value to their host communities.
With civilians desperately leaving Afghanistan, I speak to the optimistic activist Syrian refugee Hassan Akkad about his new memoir, Hope Not Fear.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. More than 2 weeks after taking control of Afghanistan, Taliban leaders are set to announce a new government. But within Afghan itself, there is still active resistance to their rule. There is fierce fighting going on in the northern Panjshir Valley, while in Kabul and other major cities, women activists bravely protest for equal rights. Across the world, in New Zealand, the Prime Minister says a known supporter of ISIS was shot and killed after stabbing six people in a terrorist attack at a supermarket in Auckland. It is the first such attack since the Taliban and ISIS-K took hold in Afghanistan. Might the New Zealand attack have been inspired at all, triggered at all by events there? Ayman Dean is a former jihadist member of Al-Qaeda who crossed over to serve as a double agent for MI6. With an inside view of the evolving global terror front. And he's joining me now. Welcome to the program. Ayman Dean, what did you think when you heard that this had happened and it's being attributed to ISIS ideology all the way over in New Zealand?
It signals that, well, there is a renewed hope for those who were inspired by ISIS since 2014. And of course, their morale was broken in 2019 when their caliphate was destroyed in Iraq and Syria. Nonetheless, they feel that the departure of the United States from Afghanistan and the release of so many ISIS prisoners from the prisons there will give them a renewed hope, a sense of hope. So the attack in Kabul happened. Of course, it will inspire others to come out of their sleeper cell mode, if we can call it this way, and start attacking, their own countries.
Do you fear, given all your experience, having been in a Taliban camp, well, with Al-Qaeda for a while, then turning, flipping, knowing so much that you do know from direct experience, do you believe with the Taliban now back in control, and as I said, a nascent ISIS-K movement in Afghanistan, that it will become again a haven, a safe haven for the kind of terrorism that committed 9/11?
Well, Christiane, anyone who lived in Afghanistan for as long as I did in the camps prior to 9/11 will tell you that Afghanistan is very difficult to police, even by the Taliban or by any strong military power. And therefore, the many valleys and the ravines and, the expanse of the cave networks there will give any group the ability to start military training camps. And with now the ability to have, communication with the outside world, which wasn't available before 9/11 through mobile phone and internet, it will become a safe haven again for those who want to, formulate plots against their own countries, whether in the West or the East.
Ayman, back in the 90s, the West tried to get the Taliban to expel Al-Qaeda, even before 9/11. You were there. They obviously are telling the current Taliban not to allow it to invite, terrorists back in. From what you remember, and what do you remember about how they reacted to this Western demand back then? and what they might do now?
Well, I mean, the problem is there are many people who believe the Taliban changed. You know, how can we say that when actually for 19 years, Al-Qaeda fighters were fighting alongside them against the American forces and NATO forces and the Afghan government? You know, so 19 years of camaraderie, they are not going to basically just abandon this in a whim. I mean, and therefore, I believe that the Taliban will continue to have that soft spot in their hearts towards those who basically preach global jihad. They might not believe in global jihad themselves and its ideology, but they believe in supporting those who are called in their ideology oppressed. And therefore, they will continue supporting Al-Qaeda and hosting them in a clandestine way, at least, for the foreseeable future.
And just to remind, they refused the Western demand to throw out Al-Qaeda last time, and that led to 9/11 eventually. So what do you think now, as we read reports, the Taliban officials, the Qatari officials, all the Western officials, you know, they're talking about a new government there. What kind of a Taliban government do you think they can set up, and what will they do?
Well, I mean, for the Taliban, they did not fight 19 years only basically to have a government that doesn't look exactly like the government they had before 9/11. The Taliban belonged to the Dioband school of jurisprudence in Islam. They are Hanafi, and they are quite strict about the application of Sharia according to the teachings of the Dioband school. And therefore, they will continue to do what they did basically in the 1990s, albeit with a little bit more moderate, softer tone to some of the aspects of social life, such as, you know, female education and employment. But they will be working so hard in order to push back the gains that women made throughout the past 19 years. But nonetheless, it's not going to be that much different, you know, from, you know, 1996 until 2001.
And you've written about all of this in your memoir. You were, you know, part of them. You believed in it. You flipped. You helped MI6. You helped some U.S. Save some U.S. lives. So you took the measure of them. Right now, we have women in various cities protesting. They're coming out in Kabul, Herat, and other places to demand their equal rights. We have this nascent resistance movement. The son of the great Ahmad Shah Massoud is trying to push back. Does this have any chance at all? Let's just talk about the resistance, the actual armed resistance against them.
I don't think they do. And there is a good reason for that. It's because in between 1996 until 2001, the border with Tajikistan was open, wide, and it was under the control of Ahmad Shah Massoud forces. Now, however, the border crossings, all of them basically, are controlled by the Taliban, and therefore the forces of Ahmad Massoud, his son, and the vice president, now, you know, the self-appointed president Amrullah Saleh, their forces actually are more or less concentrated in the Panjshir Valley, but surrounded completely by Taliban territory. Unless if you supply them from the air, where will the supplies come from? They might put up a resistance, you know, for a month or two, or maybe they can last the winter, but then come the next spring and next summer, will they be able to last, without a border with an outside, friendly nation like Tajikistan? I don't see any hope for them, unless if they push really hard towards the north in order to capture at least, some border crossings. I don't see this happening.
In the meantime, of course, the Taliban have sucked up all the important military equipment and all the information that the US and NATO has left behind. Eamon Dean, thank you so much for your perspective on this. Now, the global war on terror is a direct product of Al-Qaeda's September 11th attacks 20 years ago this month. A new Netflix movie called Worth explores the daunting challenge behind the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund. It was the first of its kind, deciding what each individual life was worth to those left behind. Here's a look.
I need an equal payment for everybody. My daughter's worth just as much as anybody in a corner office.
My wife died that day. And everything about this formula offends me. Sorry to hear that.
But we can't bend the rules for every case.
Why not? Congress gives you broad discretion. But when 7,000 citizens ask you not to be treated like some numbers on a spreadsheet, you act like that law came down from Sinai.
Kenneth Feinberg was the lawyer placed in charge of the compensation fund. He's played by Michael Keaton in a script written by Max Borenstein. And they all are joining me now. Everyone, welcome to the program. Great to speak to you about the film. I've seen it. I've seen a screener. Really, really interesting. And I wonder whether any of you thought that it would be released not just on the anniversary, but with this implosion happening in Afghanistan, with the same forces rising again in Afghanistan. Michael Keaton, what do you think, knowing that your film is coming out in this unbelievable atmosphere?
Well, no. The answer is no. Could I have imagined this? No. There was a concerted effort after a while to hold the movie to coincide closely with the anniversary, which I think is a good decision. But what's happened now, the implosion or explosion, no. And it's so disturbing and complex. Now, whether or not that adds to, the general interest in it, and people being more curious about it. First of all, for many people who are in their, or younger, that this will all be new anyway. I don't know. It sounds too opportunistic, I think, to say, well, gee, this is a great thing, or this is a bad thing. It is what it is. And I think they're not two separate things. But in this case, we just wanted to tell the story of the compensation fund and how it worked, and also to say what it meant to not only the city of New York, but to America and the world, really.
So let me ask you, Max, because you're the screenwriter, the script writer. So how do you tell a story that is emotional, but also quite dry and factual and financial, to have the kind of impact that Michael is talking about?
Well, that was the challenge. I mean, I think through Ken's eyes and speaking to Ken about his journey emotionally, as a government, a civil servant whose job it was to execute a law, but who was thrust into a position of having to deal with the wide swath of lives impacted traumatically by 9/11. It was through his eyes that I think we were able to find an emotional way of telling a story that otherwise could easily have fallen into a kind of dry bureaucratic procedural, or on the other hand, into veering into melodrama. So hopefully we achieved that. But walking the line between those two poles was the challenge.
Yeah, it's so interesting you say dry, melodrama, but also the emotion of it, because, everybody's going to remember where they were on 9/11 and now ask 20 years later in the full view of what's transpired, literally full circle, what happened in these last 20 years. So, Ken Feinberg, you have done this. This was the first of its kind. And you and your colleagues have done the same in other victim compensation funds subsequently. How important was it for you to take on this role, to accept the president asking you to do it, and to achieve what you achieved?
Well, I think when I volunteered to do this and to do it without compensation, it was a patriotic thing to do. I think there were probably millions of Americans that would have been willing to try and do this. I just thought at the time everybody was trying to do what they could do to assist the country and assist the victims. What made this so difficult was the fact that just 13 days after the attacks, the fund was created. There was no time for mourning or to assuage grief. We were dealing with very raw emotional individuals. And one thing about the screenplay and Michael's portrayal, they caught it. I was very dubious at the time that my book could ever be turned into a film. But Max Bornstein reinforced the notion that it could be done. Michael Keaton hit it to a T perfectly, and as did the others in the movie. And much to my surprise and satisfaction, the movie is a pretty fair depiction of what we went through with the 9/11 Fund.
So that is high praise indeed from the man at the center. Michael Keaton, what made you want to play Keith Feinberg? How much interaction did you have? How much research did you do with him? I mean, you're both talking to me now, and it's great to have, you know, the two protagonists, silver screen and real life, talk about this relationship. What was it like for you learning about him and how he did it?
Ken Feinberg, there's no way to do this. There's, at least I can't do it without knowing, meeting and talking to the actual person. I enjoy his company an awful lot, so that made it that much easier. And I drilled down pretty deeply with them, but you know, at some point you just have to interpret it, you know, and otherwise we're all making a documentary, and you got to tell a story in 2 hours. That's a whole other discussion on how to do it. So asking Ken the appropriate questions, but then also just observing him, and you know, the way a person walks, talks, expresses himself will tell you a lot about it. They'll tell you a lot about themselves without knowing that they're telling you about themselves if you're observing them. So you know, you just. Honestly, I keep saying this, but really it's just the job. You know, it's just, you just do the work. I really wanted to do this. I thought Max did he's a great writer. And he, when we first met a long time ago about this, before we even made the movie, I thought this is a story that has to be told, I think, you know, and I knew it was difficult and he knew it was difficult. And it's important, you know, it is. And I don't want to sound, pretentious, or you know, I don't care how I sound. It is important. It's movies like this are important. There aren't many of them around anymore. And I will tell you this. Ken and I talk about this a lot. He keeps saying you couldn't do this today because of the divisiveness, and I think he's probably right. And I find it sickening. And I watched Biden this morning. And I thought his speech was really good. I kind of wished he'd have said, you know what, these job numbers aren't good. And then he went from there. But he was correct in what he said generally. But what he talks about, and I like when he goes off script and just speaks to someone. Without sounding Pollyannish, this is the time. This is exactly the time. We can't waste this stupid energy in this. Back then, people didn't have the time to say, well, he's a jerk, and I hate that senator. There was no time for that. And the truth is, there's no time for it now. There's no time for that. Whether you like somebody or not, that's besides the point. We've got work to do. Ida.
Okay.
COVID.
I mean, exactly. I'd like to play a clip because, you're referencing quite a few of the quite, you know, it's quite complicated in the end. And here yes. In this clip that we've got from you guys is you playing Ken and basically explaining to your team the idea of calculating worth.
It's really complicated.
80% Priya.
That's our target from the DOJ.
If we don't hit that number, the plan won't work.
Any fewer claimants come aboard, the lawsuits that result could crater the economy. So we're told.
No pressure, people.
Now, for every claimant, we'll need to calculate a dollar value for the human loss, whether it's loss of limb or loss of life. Most of the people who died that day were providers for their families. We can't bring them back, but we can help their loved ones pay their bills.
Now you people understand we're not going to be able to haggle every case subjectively. That's where the math comes in. So we're going to need a rubric.
These are the latest actuarial tables from the top casualty and life insurance companies, and we'll use these numbers as a basis.
Yeah, you guys study up on these and help Camille come up with a proposal.
Ken Feinberg, is it hard 20 years later, or even at the time, to see that and to know that you had to put a dollar value? and also how you had pushback at the beginning, and actually right to the very end, you didn't get your 80%, actually it was higher target. Was the pushback from people difficult for you to take?
Yeah, very difficult. First of all, judges and juries around our country do this every day. In every village, hamlet, town, city, they calculate dollars when there's a tort injury or automobile accident, etc. What made this so difficult, as portrayed on the movie, first, a collective group, you're talking about 5,000 people who were either killed or physically injured in the attacks. And they're all, as a group, coming at you at once. The second problem, already discussed, the program was established by Congress days after the attacks. There was no time to let emotions sort of simmer down a little bit. So my effort to deal with numbers, as Michael demonstrates in the screenplay and in the movie, was a perfectly reasonable precedent for doing this, but we underestimated the degree of raw outrage, anger, frustration, disappointment, horror. And fortunately, over the course of 33 months, we managed to convince just about everybody to come into the fund, take the funds, don't go to court. And we resolved the problem the way Congress really wanted it to be resolved.
So let me ask you, Max, then, because Stanley Tucci plays the great central character who's against this, Charles Wolfe. And here's a clip of him, and we'll just play it, and then I want to ask you about formulating him as a character in the film.
Hey, I want to thank you for your help back there.
Oh.
I got to tell you,
Hey, Rob, there's a website at the bottom there. First meeting is tomorrow.
A little worried when you stood up. I'm glad you did.
Well, I believe in civility, Mr. Feinberg.
Yeah.
Charles Wolfe. And you'll be seeing a lot of me.
Oh, good to know. And it's Ken.
I think you're going to find that I'm one of your harshest critics.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, my wife died that day. And everything about this formula offends me.
So, Max, I find him really fascinating. You know, he's not a flamethrower, but he's absolutely central to the success of all of this. Just talk to me about the Charles Wolfe character and how it built towards the crescendo that he kind of made Ken's case for him.
Yeah, I think, you know, Charles is a fascinating and really inspiring guy. He lost his wife in 9/11, and he was offended by the existence of the fund because it mandated that that people be compensated for for their loved ones differently, that there wasn't some lump sum. Now, of course, that made sense from a pragmatic standpoint in order to prevent people from suing. But it was, you know, you were talking about your loved ones. And I think what's fascinating about him as a foil for Ken dramatically in the film and in real life is that they're both coming from the right place. They're both trying to do the right thing. And there are no villains in this story. The villains in this story, before the story started and caused the tragedy. At this point, from that point on, Ken was trying to do his civic duty and execute this law to the best of his abilities to help do his part to compensate these families. And Charles was trying to advocate for his wife's memory and for collectively everybody who was harmed in 9/11 and wanted their government to recognize their loved ones in a way that was beyond dollars and cents. And I think putting those two characters against one another, and as it happened in real life, I think is messy and difficult because they're both right, and there is no easy answer.
I,
something? Michael, I just want to expand a little bit on your illustrious career, because everybody knows you from such a huge panoply of films, not least, of course, The Batman. You've done a lot of social justice, political activist films in recent years, and you even played the great CNN producer during the first Gulf War in Live from Baghdad, Robert Wiener, our producer.
Right.
But The Batman, back in, 30 years ago, then you had a hiatus, then you came back, Birdman. That was a sort of a satire of Batman, if I could say. And now you're back doing The Flash, which is the Batman again. Tell me about that attraction for you and why you've gone back to it.
Oh, I think I caught up with it culturally. It transcended a big, fun, colorful action movie in all these years. It's become, just on a corporate level alone, just it's massive. Not just the Batman franchise or all the Marvel movies, the DC Comics movies. That whole world is so huge. And I thought, first of all, I think I had another perspective on it. And I thought, to circle back, over the years, I kind of thought, I'll bet you I could swing back around and still do that in the back of my head. I wanted to see if I could pull that off. And it was great, great fun to do, really, really. And you know, the first little film I ever did was a documentary, really, directed by a woman named Fern Field. And it was a little, very short film. I think she won a little award for it. And it was based on, it was about servicing handicapped people, ramps and everything. Right. And my mom was essentially a handicapped person because she had a stroke when I was 18, and for most of her life she was a victim of a stroke and she lost use of her right side and everything. So that was really the first thing I ever did. But I was always kind of aware of things like that. I come from a generation of, people who, were somewhat socially conscious. I'm not really a crusader, but these kind of movies are important. And the other thing I'll say about this movie is, okay, I did it. I had to say the words. I had to understand. I still don't totally understand the compensation fund. It's so complex. And in a movie like this, these movies, to make a good version, it's really hard to make a good version of this movie, because in life, a lot of those people, Ken will tell you, there are a lot of people who still are not. You can't. There's no way to make everyone happy. There just is no way. It's just impossible. And when people see this film, so far, we're getting very, very, very good notices. But there will be people who, and I knew it when we started making it, because as Max said, there's no villain here. There's no clear villain. So there are going to be people who are not happy with this, I'm sure. And I totally understand it. But, I believe you got to put these things out in the world. You don't want to leave the world going, I never really did much. That's kind of what I think. And the Flash is fun. I'm sorry I went off. And hello to Robert, by the way.
No, it's okay. Yeah, I'll tell him. But I do actually want to pick up on something you just said, and Ken mentioned it, the way you perform this character. A prominent film producer said to me about you, Michael Keaton, that your facial management is masterful, that you do this stuff in some of these films that in real life you might not perceive if you're shooting, but it turns up on the screen amazingly, and it completely shifts the mood, the sentiment. And I saw that happening in this film. And I just wondered, is that a thing with you?
I suppose so. I've heard it before. I don't know. Now I don't, I guess it is. I don't think about it. Now I'm going to think about it. Thanks a lot.
I don't think there's...
Well, listen, really great film. Go ahead.
I don't think there's anybody I can think of that could have portrayed what I confronted during the actual administration of the 9/11 fund better than Michael Keaton. And I, as I said earlier, I was very dubious about this, but he did it. He did it. And he's an honorary member of my family, I'll tell you that.
High praise indeed. Kenneth Feinberg, Max Borenstein, Michael Keaton, thank you both very much indeed. And of course, Worth releases on Netflix today. We turn now to a small neighborhood in New Orleans and a football program that aims to do much more than just win championships. Washington Post sports journalist Kent Babb follows a high school football season in his new book, Across the River. In a state that had the highest rate of homicides per 100,000 back in 2019, Babb's book is a stark look at the fight to keep young students out of the line of fire. And now George Clooney has snapped up the film rights. Babb spoke to Walter Isaacson alongside Nick Forster, a former football coach at the Edna Carr High School.
Thank you. And Kent Babb and Coach Nick Forster, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us on.
You have this wonderful book, Kent Babb, called Across the River. It's about Edna Carr High School in a troubled part of New Orleans. It's about kids surrounded by gun violence and an amazing coach named Bryce Brown, who helps rescue some of them. Tell me the arc of the story and why you believe it's an American story, Kent.
Yeah, I believe that in most cities in the country, there are places like Algiers, you know, where people who look like me are just perfectly content to not think about it, you know, not pay too much attention, just sort of go along your business and stroll down the French Quarter, pretend like that's not real. And, you know, there's a sort of incredible drama that's playing out. I mean, these are real lives and real vulnerable lives as well. You know, and they come to these coaches, Coach Foster and Coach Brown, you know, to look for guidance, to look for mentorship, sometimes for food. And, you know, football is just something I think that draws them to the football office. And then from there, they start retraining them for real life.
You know, Nick Foster, you were part of that Edna Carr High School football program, and you really had two paths in lives. And in some ways, you tested both of those paths. Tell me how this program and your life was changed.
Well, I went to Carr, but also I coached at Carr. But that culture, our school family, is just a big part of who we are. You're going to always have two choices. You go left, you go right. All right, and we know that left choice is not always the best decision, but when you go right, it's just a blessing and an amazing feeling. And we teach the boys all the time, New Orleans is a very adverse city, right? Either you could be a part of that or you could change it, or you could be a part of something different. And that's what we offer them with football. I went through a lot of adversity in my early years of coaching, as Kent put in the book, with my mother passing. That was tough, but I relied on my Carr family, and he got me through that. And also with my dad, we won the state championship 2019, and my dad passed away that same night. And only thing that got me through that was my Carr family. So just like we helped those players helped me. They still call me every day, check on me. They're so proud of me. I'm a head coach at St. Aug now, and it's an amazing feeling. It's bigger than just, you know, football and us, our success on the field. It's about our success off the field and helping these young men grow into better citizens.
And Kent, when you were seeing that, when you were covering the Edna Carr School for that one season, what was the magic that the coach brought to this?
I mean, it's almost not even magic. It's something so basic, and that's just honesty. You know, if a kid comes to the coaches with the crisis, no matter the hour, no matter the crisis, you know, they help deal with it. I mean, the way that I put it is, it's the rarest kind of mentorship. It's consistent. And, you know, it doesn't matter what time of day. It doesn't matter, you know, if it's 3 o'clock in the morning, these coaches, for better or worse, will answer that phone. They teach these kids to know how to trust and know who to trust, who to come to if you're out of money and hungry, who to come to if you need a ride across the river to an unfamiliar neighborhood or to get back home. You know, not just walking around in a city where bullets are flying all the time. They know the answers. The coaches know the answers. Sometimes these kids don't. And so they learn that there's an office full of adults who won't give up on them. If this is a country and maybe even a city that's just completely content to write off young people and young people of color in particular, there's one office in New Orleans that's not the case. Like, they can come at any time of day, doesn't matter the situation, and they will be supported and guided and mentored.
You know, part of the story of this book is the story of gun violence. Nick, will you tell me about the gun violence and how different it is today than it was when you were growing up?
You know, when we had altercations, sometimes, you know, it might get to a physical fist fight or something like that. But New Orleans had got to the point now where it's evolved, where these kids got easy access to a gun, and you know, they don't even know how to handle altercation. So like Ken explaining, they come to us when they're in adverse situations, and we try to, you know, detour them away from using a gun or even using violence, right? We try to change them off the field, how to handle a confrontation, how to talk things out. Right now in the city of New Orleans, there's just so much crime with adolescent kids and with the guns and everything. We just find that football is an escape for those kids. I mean, it's not only gun violence, like killing each other down there. We have robberies, like just a lot of carjackings by adolescent kids and stuff like that. But it's so easy to get a gun, and you know, they don't know how to handle, like, if they have a disagreement, if they have a confrontation. That's why we teach our kids how to handle it. Like, we actually teach these kids how to deal with these adverse situations. We teach them how to, like, when they get pulled over by a police officer, how to deal with that situation. We teach them, like, if your friend is in a negative beef situation, a controversy situation, that's not the guy you need to be hanging with. You need to be friends with the guy who's going to school, who's going to practice with you every day, your teammate. And if you see your teammate doing this, hold him accountable and let him know right from wrong. Once we start spraying this type of thing through culture, like Bryce says, cancer, like cancer spreads. You want to spread good cancer throughout your team, throughout your culture. So once we start teaching kids in the community to do right and wrong, and what's right and wrong, and to be accountable, I feel we could find a solution for it. But right now, with them having so much easy access to guns, and don't know how to use a gun and know how to handle confrontation, it's going to be them killing each other.
Kent, tell me the story of Tonka George.
So Tonka is a young man who did everything right. In 2010, he led Carr to the state championship games. He's the skin and bones punter and wide receiver who got thrust into being a quarterback because he was willing to sacrifice himself. And he was almost a supernatural leader who could inspire somebody and chew out somebody else, just whatever it took. So they got to the state championship in 2010 on Tonka's skinny shoulders. He got a college scholarship. He played college football at Alcorn State, got his degree. He was not involved in crime or drugs or anything like that. But he made a mistake, and that mistake was coming home to see his mom. He came home to New Orleans, and while he had been gone getting his education, some of his friends from back home had gotten themselves mixed up into something really dangerous. And his second mistake was taking a walk in his neighborhood on the West Bank on a warm June night 5 years ago. And somebody in a car saw him, followed him, and got out and shot and killed him. And it's a heartbreaking story, but as much as that, it's also maddening because nobody knows why he got killed. You know, nobody knows who did it. You know, 5 years later, his murder, like so many in New Orleans, remains unsolved. I mean, this is a city that recently has only solved a third of its murders, which is excruciatingly low. And, you know, Tonka was supposed to be somebody that everybody looked up to, somebody that people at Carr longed to be like. And he wound up being sort of the opposite of that. He's somebody that you can't be like this, even though he did everything right. I think he was the person that changed the Carr program forever, because Bryce was at the crime scene. He was in this sea of chaos. And I believe it was at that moment that Bryce Brown decided, my program is not just about football anymore. He's got two relentless dual missions. One, yes, is to win football games. The other is to keep his kids, the people that these coaches care and love, care about and love, keep them alive and teach them how to survive no matter what.
He was one of those kids that everybody followed. Right. And, you know, everybody looked up to, but he was something to look up to. I mean, he still has the record in the state championship for the most yards in one game, things like that. And it was skin and bones, like Kent mentioned, but it's just a special, blessed talent and just guilty by association. You know, his murder still is a mystery. And, you know, it's sad. You know, his number 5 is a special number in Carr's program and our family. And the kids really honor that number. Like, if they wear it, they make sure they try to live up to it. But it's a sad story. Bryce keeps his jersey, a picture, a shirt of Tonka in his office, and just walking in there every time and just remind us of, you know, it's bigger than football. It's bigger than just winning. Like, we got to really save lives. We really got to help these kids, because the gun violence and everything they're going through is like, he's not even involved in that type of life. But just being guilty by association, by your next door neighbor, a guy you grew up with, you could easily lose your life in New Orleans. And it's sad.
This program at Edna Carr High School, and I hope what Nick Foster is now doing at St. Augustine High School, is teaching people not just football, but the skills of life. It's almost hoping to rescue some of them from going down the wrong path. Explain that in your book.
I mean, based on my observation, football is the thing that gets these kids through the door. You know, they want to play. They want to get on the field. And who makes that decision but the coaches? And it's not always how well they perform on the field, how they catch passes, how they block defenders. It's about character. It's about communication. It's how you talk to your fellow person. You know, and what these guys do is they simulate, almost as a conditioning exercise, how to deal with these confrontations. I mean, it's uncomfortable. I've witnessed plenty of them, sometimes late at night, but it's uncomfortable. He's laughing, but it's uncomfortable.
Why are you laughing, Coach?
Well, he's referring to something when you read the book. Is at Carr, we used to call it, well, they call it pride panel. And what we do, we simulate pressure situations. So it teaches them how to think, even on the field. Everybody think because we won, you know, a couple state championships, it comes from the X's and O's and the plays. Now, it comes from the binding and the brotherhood, and we make them go through an adverse situation. So when they're on the field, when they're in the community together, they know how to handle it.
Kent, tell me the story of Joe Thomas.
Joe was somebody that before I started reporting this, I don't think I would have believed he was real. So he's a senior linebacker when the book begins. Just like kind of this inglorious run stopper, not a guy who makes sacks or anything like that. But he quite literally grew up on the streets of New Orleans. His mom was on the wrong side of the law, had been since she was a teenager. And Joe was her lookout. You know, he used to stay up until 3 a.m. with a little gun in his hand, making sure nobody came for his mom. And so he grew up as a protector. And as he grew, it was almost like there were two people in the world, Joe and his mom. He didn't know how to communicate. He certainly didn't know how to communicate with adults without being confrontational. And he had just never been held accountable in his life. He had never been held to a schedule in his life. And so he's somebody that has completely changed how I look at communities like this, because it's just too easy to think that it can't be that bad, that somebody like Joe is made up. It's not. I mean, there's a lot of Joes out there, not that many Coach Browns and Coach Fosters. And the fact that, like, Joe learned these tricks of survival that seem unnecessary in the United States. I mean, if he walked to McDonald's to get some dinner, he never came back the way he went, just in case somebody was following him and trying to hunt him down and kill him. He had to hide in abandoned houses because, whether it was real or imagined, he believed somebody might be chasing him at all times. He felt like he had to protect himself. When the book begins, his mom is in prison. Joe is living by himself as an 18-year-old young man. His senior year is getting ready to start, and he's got an eviction notice posted to his front door. He has no idea how to deal with this. How do you deal with that when you're 18? It's over $80. He's about to be homeless, over $80. So what do you do? I think if not for the Carr program, he would have made a very different decision. But because he played for Edna Carr High, and because he had these coaches, he knew who to go to, and they helped him get out of what could have been a life-changing and possibly life-ending jam.
When Katrina hit, Edna Carr, it's on the West Bank. It's across the river from most of New Orleans. And so it didn't flood. And Edna Carr High School became a place where people from all over the city, when they came back, had to go. So you had a lot of people from different neighborhoods going to Edna Carr. Coach Nick, tell me how that affected things.
Well, before Katrina, Edna Carr was a magnet school. So we had to take a test to get in Carr. And it was most people from Algiers went to Carr. It's a tight-knit community, very small. It was a 3A school. And after Katrina, you know, a lot of the schools on this side of the river, on the East Bank, really was closed down because of it was underwater. Well, Carr was one of the ones that survived the storm. So all these kids from on the other side of the river started coming in. So it wasn't no tests. You know, we just had to get kids in school. Now, at first, we thought it was a bad thing because, you know, we car and certain people can only take that test and be in our family. But it actually expanded our family and made it amazing. We was getting a different type of athlete in car, different type of kid, more kids with adverse situations, more kids that wanted more. They wanted out of LGS, so they used car as a path, as a channel to get out. So they used football in education. Carr was able to offer them that.
Kent?
I mean, I think it made people from all over a city that's, at least from my observation, is extraordinarily territorial. You know, this is a place where people grow up on a certain block in a certain neighborhood, and they don't always leave that block, and they certainly don't trust somebody who doesn't live on that block. And so, right. You know, what Katrina did is it uprooted everybody, including some sort of some decisions that were from short-sighted city officials. It uprooted everybody and forced everybody into unfamiliar neighborhoods. So what that did is raise tensions. And in the case of Carr, it made so many people have to filter into this one place and not just have to coexist with each other, but to line up beside each other and play with each other and learn how to pursue opportunities and victories together. You know, you had to learn how to trust. You had to learn how to rely on these people that didn't sound like you or supposedly look like you. They weren't from where you're from, but suddenly you're on the same team.
Coach Nick Foster, Kent Babb, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.
And finally tonight, since the frantic evacuation began in Kabul, over 23,000 Afghans have been flown to the United States, and tens of thousands of more are trying to flee Taliban rule, crossing borders often on foot. Western countries have committed to taking in some, but is it enough, and how will they be welcomed? Syrian filmmaker and activist Hassan Akkad understands the pain of being uprooted. He sought asylum here in the UK in 2015. At the peak of the pandemic, he worked on the front lines of London's COVID wards. And now he's out with a new memoir, Hope, Not Fear. And Hassan is joining me now from here in London. Hassan, welcome back to this program where we've chronicled part of your journey since you fled that last big war, Syria. So let me just ask you what you think when you see your Afghan brothers and sisters trying to do the same thing and having such a hard time now getting out.
Thank you for having me, Christian. It's certainly very triggering to see people fleeing, packing their lives in suitcases and going to the unknown. Certainly, Afghan refugees are not, I mean, before Afghanistan, we had Venezuela, Syria, Rohingya refugees, and it's the refugee population, it keeps on growing and growing because of man-made crises and the climate change. So just seeing these images of people who are fleeing makes me very sad, because I've been in this place before. When I've read a lot of interviews that people have interviewed Afghans who made it out of Afghanistan, and the one thing that said in common was that we are very lucky. And that is very true, because people who make it are very lucky. But I feel bad for the ones who were left behind, because only the tiny majority of people who made it out of Afghanistan, the rest are still behind.
Well, let me ask you then, because the British government has said that it's going to accept some 20,000 over a period of years. The American government basically called this the biggest humanitarian airlift in history. And now there are reports that there was only a pretty small fraction of Afghans who were airlifted. And obviously the rest were Americans. Given that some of these so-called welcome red carpets are based on what governments did for Syrian refugees, of which you were one, what hope do you genuinely have for all the promises that well-meaning governments are trying to cover themselves in now to the civilians they've left behind?
I'll give you the British government as an example. They committed to resettle 20,000 Afghans, which is a very small number compared to the number of people who are fleeing Afghanistan. The majority of refugees stay in the region, so the majority have gone to neighboring countries around Afghanistan. And quite a lot of people who've worked with the British Army and the American armies in Afghanistan are still left behind under the Taliban rule. So I think that Western governments should do more. They should step up, and they should the resettlement should be quicker. In Britain right now, there are 3,000 Afghan asylum seekers who've been waiting to hear for the cases for years, not being able to work and living in limbo, which could really, could really affect them. They can't integrate. They can't, you know, find purpose. And I hope that governments step up and do more.
So I want to ask you about the general, I guess, hysteria in many countries about refugees and migration. You saw what happened in 2015 when the Syrians came out, and it just turned politics upside down, nativism all over the world, at least in our countries. I want to read you a statistic from Oxford University, which said that those who originally came to seek asylum here in the UK made up an estimated 0.6 of the UK population in 2019. So it's really very tiny. And we've heard from Syrians like yourself, we are hearing from Afghans now, that they want to go to these countries and contribute and pay their taxes and do the right thing and start a new life. So I want to ask you about the title of your book, Hope Not Fear, but you say, finding my way from refugee to filmmaker to NHS hospital cleaner and activist. That is pretty much giving back. Clearly it was a calculated subtitle. What were you hoping to achieve with that long, you know, all-inclusive subtitle?
Christiane, as humans, we are programmed to listen to stories. Stories can help us make sense of the world. Storytelling is a very, very powerful tool. And this is what I wanted to do by writing this book. I wanted to write my story just 10 years ago, I was in Damascus going to gigs and having a very comfortable life. And then suddenly I hit rock bottom, and this could happen to anyone. So I wanted people to know what it feels like to be uprooted and having to do these journeys to seek asylum in and live in exile for many years. And more importantly, I wanted people not just to I wanted people not just to walk in my footsteps, but I also I'm hoping that people could, be inspired and do something, because certainly now, refugees do need help in their host communities. And we've seen incredible examples here in Britain where people have offered their spare rooms to refugees, loads of donations from communities to people who have arrived here. And I'm this is the message of my book. Hope on its own is very passive, but when it's linked with action, it can actually change people's lives. It can do something.
Exactly. And you've said they don't want sympathy. You want an opportunity. But let's just quickly go back to the drama. Obviously, in Afghanistan, people are fleeing what they think are going to be a cutthroat Taliban. You write a very important passage in Hope Not Fear about what got you into the biggest trouble, and that was a meeting with the dictator Bashar Assad, in which you were urged to speak the truth, and then you paid for it. Tell me about that meeting.
Christiane, I took part in the protests, in the peaceful protests, in the early uprising, and as a result, I got detained and tortured, and then, I don't know, I was naive enough to think that I can go and speak to Bashar al-Assad and change his mind about the uprising. And it led to a second detention. I never wanted to leave. You know, that's the thing. There's a misconception that people always want to come to the West. No, I was comfortable enough in my own country. But then when you run out of options, you are presented with two choices. You either leave or you die. And then that I had to flee. And my story is one of millions of other people, as I told you, like from Syria, who had no other choice than to seek asylum in other countries. And most people stay in the region. That's the thing. Like we make such a fuss about immigration and refugees, while in Britain, less than 1% of the refugee population is here. So I've written this book hoping that it will change people's minds. It will help them look at the subject differently, in a different way.
Well, interestingly, that's pretty realistic hope, because during the COVID crisis, you challenged the government on a lot of issues, and it was the British government. And it was, you know, it was heard and it was noted. So, Hassan Akkad, thank you for your activism and for your optimistic activism in these terrible, terrible situations, author of Hope Not Fear. And that's it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.